Welcome to Uncharted, an Arctic 360 podcast about the impact of COVID-19 on the North American Arctic. All summer long, we're talking to the people who live, work, and govern the Arctic to understand how we move forward from this moment in history. Last year, in June 2019, the Canadian Senate released a report titled Northern Lights, a wake-up call for the future of Canada. It warned of a crisis in the Arctic, created through decades of neglect, climate change, and a lack of infrastructure that leaves the North vulnerable to crisis. But it also predicted that the Arctic could play a central role in Canada's future. 1 year later, I wanted to know, has that changed? One of the people involved in that study is our guest today, Senator Dennis Patterson, who is also the former Premier of the Northwest Territories. Together, we reflected on the findings of that report and what has changed as a result of the pandemic. But mostly, we talk about the way forward, how to implement the tools necessary for economic security in the North when the resources already exist. I'm Erica Wallace, and when it comes to COVID-19, this is Uncharted.
Senator, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome.
We're talking about, you know, it's been 1 year since the release of the Senate's Arctic report. That was 2019. You know, when I was reading it, the sort of thesis of it is that the Arctic is the future of Canada. I wanted to know, what did you mean by that then, and how has that changed now as a result of COVID?
Yes, well, we said, you know, wake up, Canada, in our report. The Arctic is a strategic and long-neglected part of our great country that is rich with natural resources and the potential for more sustainable industries, like tourism, for example, but it is severely underdeveloped. Still, that all remains true post-COVID. So targeted investments in infrastructure and industry, as we recommended, will help Canada's Arctic grow and flourish. And I envision an Arctic region that's self-sustaining.
Right.
Meaning that we have access to various sources of own source revenues other than government, that we have a population that it can house and feed and educate on a level that is on par with Southern Canada, and that we have sufficient travel, communication, energy infrastructure to support our people. So all of that is still extant.
Last year, in September, a couple months after your report, there was also the federal government's Arctic policy framework. Do you feel that the Senate committee's recommendations are reflected in that report, or is there anything that you feel was maybe left out and that you wish was included?
The Arctic policy framework was a disappointment because it laid out very broad motherhood goals. And in our report, we stated clearly that any solutions pertaining to the North should first of all be developed in direct consultation with Northerners.
Right.
The federal government did that. And, you know, there are various partner chapters like those of the Inuit or the territories. But the Arctic policy framework is clear that those chapters may not necessarily reflect the position of the government. So by comparison, the Senate report, I think, included clear and actionable recommendations that were derived directly from testimony we gathered from stakeholders, you know, across the North, and we traveled across the North. We were solutions-oriented and tried as much as possible to steer away from motherhood statements. You know, I'll give you an example. The Arctic policy framework lists as a goal the need to, quote, integrate climate change resilience into new and existing infrastructure, end quote, as well as to, quote, strengthen community level infrastructure, including social infrastructure, end quote. So whereas, you know, by contrast, you know, I pick up some recommendations or a Senate report that I think are very concrete and clear. For example, that the government direct the National Research Council to complete a building code adapted to Arctic conditions and the effects of climate change. Secondly, implement an action plan to mitigate the effects of climate change on existing and new infrastructure, including housing. Take immediate measures to address the housing crisis in the Arctic by funding a complete continuum of Arctic housing, and fourthly, report on the effects of its investment on housing annually to local, indigenous, and territorial governments. So it's my hope that the government will look at our recommendations and see how it lays a path forward to, you know, putting flesh on the bones of their motherhood framework with the goal of achieving actions and goals in concrete terms attached to federal funding to make these much needed initiatives happen.
Right. Sounds like some specifics as well for a time frame could be sort of useful as well.
Yes, well, the government will have to reply to the Senate report within a specific time frame under the rules of the Senate. So,
okay,
we will insist on that.
How do you anticipate it will change as a result of COVID?
Well, I think COVID has heightened some of the flaws and needs that we have outlined in, for example, communications infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We became very reliant on broadband communications, you know, being in severe lockdown in all three northern territories.
Right.
And that highlighted the weaknesses of our limited broadband capacity, particularly in Nunavut, and inhibited effective communication in many ways.
Well, I guess that sort of leads into my next question, because in April of this year, in response to COVID, the federal government, they announced that there's going to be an infrastructure stimulus to sort of help us rebuild the economy. What would you like the federal government to sort of prioritize in terms of infrastructure projects in the north?
Yeah, well, I think this is a very welcome opportunity.
Right.
And there are some infrastructure projects that are important, ready to go, and are Indigenous or Northern-owned initiatives. And I'll just mention a couple that we highlighted in our report. One is the Grays Bay Port and Road Project, the first link for Nunavut to the North American highway system.
Right.
And a key to developing a resource-rich region in the western region of Nunavut. The Inuit have also, and they led that project, and they've also led a hydro fiber link in the central region of Nunavut. So those are obvious, extremely beneficial projects that immediately come to mind. We also have a Pan-Arctic fiber proposal to have Inuit lead the integration of broadband with fiber optic cable territory-wide. And finally, if we can get investments, significant investments, to alleviate our northern housing crisis, you know, this would create worthwhile jobs and business opportunities in every community and alleviate, you know, what is well documented, a plethora of social and economic barriers to wellness in the north.
It's completely crazy. You know, there are big parts of this country that don't have access to internet, access to housing, access to clean water.
Yes, and we have, you know, a $180 billion federal infrastructure fund already budgeted. It needs, you know, it's not threatened by the deficits resulting from COVID, that, you know, could be and I think must be employed in the Arctic, and not just to reduce commuter wait times in the major metropolitan centers clustered around the 49th parallel.
Right. Another question I wanted to ask you, and this is sort of because I'm a student myself, I was interested in the part of the report you're talking about how underinvestment hits hardest on the Arctic's Indigenous youth. But you say that they are also the region's greatest asset. What are the most important priorities in giving young people the tools that they need to build a better future for not just themselves, but, you know, for the communities that they live in?
Well, maybe I'll just mention one of our key recommendations.
Sure.
And, you know, education is the key to harnessing the enormous human resource potential in our extremely rapidly growing segment of our population, our youth segment. We are... And I'm speaking particularly of Nunavut and the NWT. No, we are the only circumpolar regions without a university. And so the report strongly endorsed the creation of a university in the Arctic, which will allow students to be closer to home, northern students to be closer to home in getting their education, but will also foster research and study of northern issues, and I'm sure attract circumpolar and international students as well to a very fascinating and dynamic part of the world.
I understand there was a university recently created in the Yukon, right? Would that sort of,
yes.
Could that situation be sort of replicated in Northwest Territories and Nunavut?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I know we recognize there's progress in Yukon. That's a region, of course, that's a territory, of course, that's much better served in terms of highway, broadband infrastructure, and has most of its population in one center. So
right.
We still have acute needs to serve the more remote communities and more isolated communities in NWT and Nunavut. But, you know, the Yukon initiative, which receives significant federal support, is encouraging in that respect. But we've got to move forward urgently in the NWT and Nunavut.
Right. I didn't even think about that, surrounding our infrastructure sort of impacting people's ability to even get to a university and to be attracted to that.
The University of the Arctic will have to be accessible to remote communities through broadband, and
right.
Universities around the world are doing that these days. So it's less of a brick and mortar structure than a cyber institution. It could work. It would be a wonderful place to demonstrate how this could work in a very remote, isolated, climatically challenged region.
That's interesting. Do other Arctic nations, or like, I don't know, I'm thinking Alaska or Norway, do they do sort of online classes? Is that something that's already happening?
I don't think it's happening as much in the north, but it's happening with major universities throughout the world. So
yeah,
there's no reason it can't happen in the north.
Yeah, for sure. It definitely makes sense for that region to sort of lead the way on that.
Exactly.
To pivot again, a different question, you know, we talked about in the report the creation of an Arctic infrastructure bank that would promote local growth. I really wanted to know, what does that look like? And what does the federal government's role play in that?
Well, to me, it's a dedicated pot of money that addresses northern needs that are crying for attention.
Right.
And, you know, we've called it an infrastructure bank. But basically, it's a carve-out for the North from the already budgeted $180 billion infrastructure fund for Canada.
Hmm.
So, you know, there is a Northern infrastructure component of the National Infrastructure Fund, but it's woefully inadequate in meeting the needs of the North. Part of the problem is our infrastructure needs have been underfunded for so long that now, you know, literally billions are needed to close all the gaps that exist between us and the rest of Canada. You know, fixing housing alone in Nunavut, where we've documented well over 3,000 housing unit shortages,
wow.
it would be in the range of over $1 billion. And then there's no roads between any of Nunavut's 25 communities. Very few ports, nor do we have access to any alternatives to diesel for generating power and heat. So there are massive needs, but there's a big fund. We need Canada to recognize that investing in infrastructure in the north will produce, you know, long-term multifold returns, not just for the north, but for Canada.
Right. What would the, I don't know, I guess the sort of time frame for that be, for that creation? Would you hope to see that within a couple of years?
Well, you know, it takes longer to build infrastructure in the north because we only have a limited building season. So Northerners are realistic about the need to incrementally implement infrastructure. But the Canada Infrastructure Plan is a long-range plan, and so we would gladly fit into longer-term parameters to work on these challenges within our capacity and within our logistical limits over time. No one expects a quick fix in a couple of years.
Right. You have to start somewhere, I guess, right?
Sure, and these problems have been long neglected, and so any progress, and particularly a commitment to stable funding to allow proper planning, will
right.
be the key to making this a success, rather than the pattern to date, which has been, ad hoc funding announcements, often connected with an election, not tied to any long-term sustainable plans.
Sort of building off of that, we've talked sort of all as a thread throughout about the clear argument for reliable access to the internet. What are the primary obstacles that are standing in the way universal access to broadband internet in the north?
Well, the first obstacle, of course, is that it is almost prohibitively expensive to do projects of this kind in the north. And, you know, for years now, we've been depending on satellites.
Right.
And Canada has helped to buy satellite time to improve internet access and speeds in the north. But this is a black hole for money, in my view, with no sustainability.
Hmm.
We need to be bringing up fiber optic lines from southern Canada or from abroad.
Hmm.
And those lines need to traverse large bodies of water. I mean, I live on, in the southern part of the fifth largest island of the world, New Baffin Island, and, you know, there'll have to be an undersea line built in ice-infested waters.
Right.
And builders need to contend with permafrost and other conditions that, you know, they don't encounter in the Greater Toronto Area. The government funding also has to be linked to a clear vision.
Right.
You know, we can't be paying to build the same infrastructure twice.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always advocated we need to promote competition. Now, the current Connect to Innovate program of Canada, which is about improving broadband, has in fact had the effect of perpetuating an exploitive monopoly in Nunavut and the NWT, rather than fostering competition. And the CRTC has created a broadband fund last year to aid in improving internet capacity in the north, and it's been inexplicably frozen. So we need to not only identify money for these expensive investments, knowing that they will be sustainable long term, but we also need to maximize the effect of whatever money we put into the north.
Right.
And that hasn't happened very well to date.
Problems that are easy to solve, right?
We're patient and flexible and innovative in the Arctic, and I remain optimistic, and I hope our report will help put the North on the radar of the current government.
I wanted to take a couple of minutes just at the end here, because this is the final section of your report. You talk about the Canadian Arctic in a global context. You know, I wondered if does COVID present an opportunity for Canada to finally become a leader in the North, and what do you envision for that role?
Well, you know, I'm not sure that COVID in particular is what would position Canada to be a leader in the circumpolar Arctic. Perhaps we have shown in our success in resisting the pandemic, and you know, we're very proud in Nunavut not to have had any cases in our communities. since the pandemic started, being so vulnerable because of overcrowded housing. But you know, Canada has always had the ability to become a leader in the circumpolar north. What is needed, and this is the theme of our report, is a coordinated effort amongst a variety of federal departments who often do not work in collaboration on northern issues, supported by significant long-term federal investments and political will to provide the Arctic with the opportunities it needs to flourish in the way I envisioned earlier. And, you know, the long-term vision, and I think the return on investment for Canada, is that we are rich in natural resources, not to mention our dynamic human resources. And we are therefore able, with the proper investment that has been taken for granted in southern Canada for you know, many decades, investments in highways and ports and national railways, we are in a position to become a have, you know, a contributor to the economic growth and well-being of Canada. Right. Not to mention, in the process, establishing sovereignty for Canada in an area of our country that many experts say is vulnerable to threats from abroad, military or other economic threats. So there's many dividends to be returned to Canada from finally turning towards the north as a place of opportunity and a place that can help grow our economy. And in that sense, I think we are well positioned to help respond to COVID by anchoring an economic recovery that will bring up our GDP and generate taxes and reduce welfare dependence on northern citizens. We don't want to be reliant on the taxpayers of Canada, and we don't need to be reliant on the taxpayers of Canada. Investments will yield enormous long-term sustainable returns for Canada.
Are you optimistic about the potential of Canada, of a bigger role on the stage? You know, considering these vulnerabilities, I think, in the Arctic are increasing, I think the Arctic is becoming maybe a more volatile place. Are you optimistic about Canada being able to take on that role?
Well, you know, when I look at the longer term past, you know, there have been governments that have been captivated by the vision and potential of the Arctic. And, you know, one of my heroes is former Canadian Prime Minister John Diefenbaker.
All right.
You know, who had a vision for the North and invested in the North, building railways to resources, building roads to resources. You know, the Dempster Highway from Whitehorse Dawson Creek to Inuvik, and by the way, that was expanded to Tuktoyaktuk by another Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who also had a vision for the North. When leadership at the national level in the country realizes the potential of the North, you know, great things can happen.
Right.
And I'm hopeful that will that will occur. I'm ever hopeful and ever optimistic, and this is what keeps me inspired in the work that I'm doing, is to use every opportunity and the privileged platform I have in the Senate to advocate for investment in the Arctic. And, you know, it's our Canadian identity as well. We're a great northern country.
Right.
You know, alongside Russia, we're the greatest northern country in the world. And we should celebrate that and benefit from that in ways we have not often taken advantage of.
true. Most people in America think of all of Canada as the Arctic anyways. So we might as well embrace that image, right?
Yes, but that's as far as it goes. You know, we're struggling for basic needs that Southern Canadians take for granted.
Right, for sure. Can I ask you one more question, if you don't mind? I just wondered, you know, as somebody who's worked in the North and governed the North their whole lives, what does it mean to you personally to be involved in a report like this and being able to talk to people in the North and bring that to the Senate? You know, what does that mean for you?
Well, you know, I came to work for a year starting a legal aid clinic
mm-hmm.
on Baffin Island, sort of a pilot project. In 1975, and you know, it was going to be kind of a romantic, interesting thing to do before I returned back to my position in a up and coming law firm in Southern Canada. And I just fell in love with the Arctic. You know, it's a beautiful place with wonderful, strong, resilient people, and so I've made my career and life in the North, and it's been very fulfilling. And very few Canadians have the privilege of even seeing the North,
mm-hmm.
let alone realizing its great potential. So for me to now have the opportunity to represent an Arctic region in the Parliament of Canada, and to have that platform to advocate, is an enormous privilege. And I was privileged to chair the Special Senate Committee on the Arctic. It's been, the report has been very well received in the Senate, and it has already prompted some response from the Government of Canada. You know, we recommended the creation of a dedicated Northern Affairs Minister,
right.
which the government, to its credit,
mm-hmm.
Responded to following the last election. Minister, the first Northern Affairs Minister, Vandel, has worked very collaboratively and effectively with Northern senators. There's three of us.
Mm-hmm.
To focus on the North. And, you know, we've had some good results so far, particularly in making sure that the federal response to COVID takes into account our unique needs. So it's a privilege, and I remain determined and ever optimistic that things can only improve for us.
Well, Senator, I think that's a good place to leave it. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure, Erica.
That's all for this week, and a huge thank you to Senator Patterson for taking the time today. Stay tuned for next week when we discuss Canada's Arctic foreign policy and the Arctic Council.